Welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Thank you for being with us. Whether you're listening on the radio, watching on Facebook Live, or however you happen to be tuning in, we appreciate you being here on a Thursday evening, the Feast of St. Francis. I'm Matt Swaim, filling in today as Psychelet is out. And if you know my voice, it's perhaps from the Sunrise Morning Show on EWTN Radio. I also am outreach manager for the Coming Home Network, and so I'm always excited when I can work with Catholic Answers, because at the Coming Home Network, we welcome converts home to the Catholic Church, and so many of them come to us because they read something at Catholic.com or heard something on Catholic Answers Live. And if you're one of those people who has questions about the church, we invite you to get your questions in now for our full hour. Actually got two full hours of a Q&A open forum today. First hour with Mark Brumley, president of the board of Ignatius Press. So if you want to, go ahead and give us a call now to get on the line and be in the queue for us. It's 888-318-7884. Again, the number to call to get on with your question for Mark Brumley, it's 1-888-318-7884. We'd love to hear from you. And Mark, since I've talked about you, I might as well talk to you.
Very good.
President of the board of Ignatius Press. You know, the other thing about the Coming Home Network, when people come to us because they have questions about the church, usually we say, well, let's recommend you this book from Ignatius Press.
Well,
because over the years, you guys have put out a ton of fantastic resources. It's four decades now, right?
Yeah, we've been doing it. And we have our 40th anniversary celebration coming up here in the city of St. Francis, it being his feast day and all, and it's a solemnity for us here in San Francisco. So November 2nd and 3rd, we're going to have a dinner and then a big conference the next day with Father Fessio, our founder and the editor of Ignatius Press. A few Catholic Answers listeners I know have heard Father Fessio since
just
he's a
few.
Regular.
Just a few.
Michael O'Brien,
our
novelist
Michael D.
friend, an artist. You know, he's going to be here.
Yeah, so and, lots of great people. Sounds awesome.
Yeah, Cardinal Renze, Steve Ray, Father Spitzer, Peter Kraft. It's going to be lots of fun.
Excellent. So those are some of the top apologists, again, that we've heard over the years on Catholic Answers. And we appreciate the fact that Ignatius has put them out. And we appreciate the fact that so many of them appeared on the show. And we are welcoming you to join the conversation again, 1-888-318-7884. And if you've got a question about theology, history, the fathers, scripture, saints, we just mentioned St. Francis, the church and the news even, and more. And Mark, before we get to the calls here in a second, I do want to ask a question about saints, since you invoked Francis. I wonder, because he's one of those guys that as an evangelical we thought was okay, even though he was Catholic. I guess maybe we didn't even think of him as a Catholic. I wonder how you thought of St. Francis before becoming Catholic some 40 years ago, and how you think of him now with your sort of developed understanding of the meaning of the communion of saints.
Well, here's what I would say. My initial encounter with St. Francis was as somebody who is a statue, you know, the birds come and land on and all that. I mean, that's really growing up in South St. Louis, Missouri. St. Louis is a very Catholic town. Even non-Catholics will, or they used to, I don't know if this is still a thing there, but it used to be, you know, it would not be uncommon for a non-Catholic to describe where he lives in terms of a parish. Say, you know, I'm in Epiphany Parish, or I'm St. Joan of Arc Parish, or I'm in Our Lady of Sorrows Parish. So, there were Catholic things around, and one of the Catholic things that was commonly around were these little statues of St. Francis. And I remember asking my grandmother, who was actually a Catholic, she was not practicing at that time, but I did ask her once about the statue. I said, "Who is that?" And she said, "St. Francis." She didn't know a lot about St. Francis, but you probably can predict what the one thing was she knew about St. Francis. What do you think that was, Matt?
Preaching to the birds or something, man.
Preaching, yeah, love.
Probably not the stigmata.
Lover. Animal lover. That was the one that she knew. He's an animal lover. And then my second encounter with St. Francis was, and I remember this very well, was the movie Escape from the Planet of the Apes.
Wow.
Because at the end of that movie, the character Armando, played by Ricardo Montalban, is like a circus guy. he gives this little ape, you know, a St. Francis medal. And I remember thinking, that is so stupid on so many levels. First of all, saints, what's with these saints? They're these dead people. Why are we bothering with saints when we should be focusing on Jesus? That's the first thing. Second, the idea of a medal, like, what is this? This is like superstition, you know, some kind of magical thing these Catholics give, a medal, right? And then lastly, to an ape, right? Even a supposedly, you know, in the story, an intelligent ape, but it's still an ape, right? So it was just one of those perfect coming together of science fiction, what I then thought was Catholic superstition, and my sort of fundamentalist evangelical reaction. So yeah, that was kind of my impression of St. Francis. Now, later on, when I kind of really started being a little bit, because you know, you have to remember, I was originally a pretty militantly anti-Catholic fundamentalist style Christian. So I became more broadly evangelical later on, and then, you know, I saw St. Francis as a true believer, and that may strike some people as odd, you know, when you say, well, you thought Francis was a true believer. Well, and I thought most Catholics were lost, and so Francis seemed to have a personal relationship with Jesus Christ, you know. He seemed to be sold out for Jesus, and so, you know, I was willing to give him a pass.
Yeah, well, that's funny because, you know, St. Francis is one of those guys that, you know, a lot of people, you know, even within the evangelical circles will say something to the effect of, you know, well, maybe he's a Christian within the church, maybe in spite of the church.
Right, yes, that's right. You know, that, yeah, and of course, when I moved to my more, for lack of a better term, ecumenical mode of evangelicalism from my previously militantly anti-Catholic, militantly anti-ecumenical fundamentalist mode, then, yeah, I would look at somebody like Francis and say, yeah, he was a true Christian, and probably kind of like in spite of the church. There was this idea that we had, again, when I became a little bit more broad-minded, that, you know, you could be a Christian in the Catholic Church. You could be born again in the Catholic Church. It's probably not the safest environment to be a Christian in. But, yeah, it was possible and all of that. So St. Francis was one of those people. And it's funny, you had the same thing with Augustine, although there's much more of a sort of evangelical tradition regarding honoring St. Augustine. You know, Luther was an Augustinian friar and all this kind of stuff. But we kind of looked at Augustine the same way. We said, you know, I remember a Protestant, evangelical Protestant pastor preaching once on how Augustine was raised in the church. So that was the line. He was raised in the church, but he was not a Christian and he had a born again experience. Well, there's some truth to that in the sense that he came from a semi-churched background, wasn't baptized, wasn't really raised as a Christian, and he did have an encounter with Jesus Christ as an adult. But, you know, we typically would cast all of these people that, for whatever reason, who are Catholics that we came to identify as genuine Christians, we'd have this sort of parallel conversion story, you know, that was cast in evangelical terms.
Well, Mark, you know what would have helped you a lot back then, 40 years ago, is if you'd have just had a radio program with a Q&A open forum where you could have posed these questions like our listeners are able to do now on any question.
Absolutely.
About the communion of saints, about the forgiveness of sins, about the resurrection of the body, the life everlasting, about church history, what have you. We're here to tackle them on Catholic Answers Live. So give us a call. 513, I'm giving you my personal cell phone number. That should probably not happen. 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. Get on the line with Mark Brumley from Ignatius Press. I'm Matt Swaim and would love to take your calls here at Catholic Answers Live. And Mark, you ready to take some calls after the break?
Sure, absolutely.
All right, let's do it. It's Catholic Answers Live. We're back right after this.
Every question is important. Ask yours today on Catholic Answers Live.
The leading Catholic voices are on EWTN Radio.
Our mission is to transform the world one woman at a time through a spiritual program of formation that helps them to see who they are as daughters of the Most High God and to enjoy the gift that God has given to them by virtue of their femininity.
Women of Grace with Jeanette Bankovic Williams. Tomorrow morning, 11 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite Monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
And we're back on Catholic Answers Live. I'm Matt Swaim. Glad to be here filling in from the Coming Home Network and the Sunrise Morning Show. Glad to sit in Sai's seat for a day. And glad to be along with Mark Brumley, President of the Board of Ignatius Press. And we're taking your calls in a Q&A open forum. The number to get into the mix is 1-888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. Mark, you ready for some calls?
I am ready if you are.
Let's do this. Joseph is listening in Charlotte, North Carolina. Joseph, what's your question for Mark Brumley?
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Doing great. Hey. How are you?
Okay. I'll try to keep my question short. But I am aware so far that a hopeful universalism is an allowable position within the Catholic tradition. Like people like Hans Urs von Balthasar, and I've seen bishops espouse the same view. But I've recently come across different scholars and theologians, either who are Eastern Orthodox or who are themselves Catholic, who will espouse a little bit further. They'll say, they're pretty darn sure that universalism is going to be the end game. I'm not sure if that's heretical in the eyes of Catholic Answers or in the church at large, or if it's an allowable opinion or what it's classified as. So I wonder if you guys have any clarification on that, or I hope my question makes sense. Like the
Sure.
difference between the hopeful universalism versus the more confident universalism.
Okay, well, so let me make some distinctions. Universalism can mean lots of different things. Usually it means the theological view that everyone will be saved. Now, some forms of universalism hold that only every human being will be saved. Some forms of universalism will hold that every human being and all the fallen angels will ultimately be saved. And so that's the position. Now, traditionally, the church has taught and continues to teach that anybody who dies in a state of grave sin, that is to say, who's done something seriously wrong, knows it's wrong, freely chooses to do it, that person is damned. And so damnation is not just a theoretical possibility for somebody, it's a real possibility. I could be damned, you could be damned. Many of our listeners out there, our many listeners out there could be damned if we reject God. So even when we talk about the hopefulness or a hopeful universalism, we need to be clear that this isn't just a kind of theoretical thing that might happen, that people be damned. It's actually something that can really happen to people. So that's the first point. Second point, there are theologians like Hans-Urs von Balthasar who hold what you described as a kind of hopeful universalism. I wouldn't call it universalism, but they contend that there are good New Testament theological grounds for hoping that all people will ultimately be saved. And now, how that can happen and what sense do we make of certain biblical texts that seem to indicate that people that certain people will be lost is a different question. With respect to what I think is the burden of your question, the people that hold that view, Hans-Urs von Balthasar in particular, stress that we can't know, that we can hope, but we can't know the outcome, whether there'll be a two-outcome universe with some people lost and some people be damned, or a single-outcome universe where by grace and Christ, in the end, everybody accepts God and is saved. Okay, so that's their theological view. The view that you're talking about
sort of
goes a step further and says it's not just a question of hoping for that. It's not just a question of, you know, by God's grace, we're trying to evangelize and convert everybody. No, in point of fact, everybody is going to be saved in the end, and this is just the way it is. The people I mentioned in that second camp, Hans-Urs von Balthasar, for example, would say you can't collapse the tension there. You have to maintain, the church requires you to maintain the real possibility that people can be damned. Now, there are plenty of other theologians who will say it's not just a real possibility, it's actually, we're actually, even though we can't name any particular person who's in hell, we can be reasonably sure by reading the scriptures a certain way that there are, in fact, people who are damned. So those are kind of the theological positions. I would say, my view is, that the view that of a certain universalism is false. That scripture clearly teaches that if you commit grave sin and you do it deliberately, you will be lost. And the Catholic Church has always taught that. So I don't think we can say we're certain that everybody's going to be saved. I think there are strong indications. I think you can argue this both ways. This is my opinion now, a theological opinion. I think you can argue it both ways with respect to whether it seems like it's possible that in the end everybody can be saved by Christ, or that in fact there's going to be these two outcomes where some are lost and some are saved. But whatever you think of that debate, it would seem to me that the view that we are can be certain that everybody will be saved, that is contrary to the teaching of Scripture, the teaching of Jesus, the teaching of the Catholic Church.
At the very least, Joseph, can I make a personal recommendation to you? Don't live your life under the assumption that you'll probably be saved no matter what at the end. That's not a risk that I personally would be willing to take.
Right.
If that makes sense.
I mean, yeah. even if... you know, these universalists are correct. I don't think anyone wants to go to a sort of purgatorial hell or an eternal hell. They both seem like bad ideas. So
that's right.
Yeah, and I don't want to be the guinea pig for that either.
Yeah, and ultimately, if someone comes to understand who God is and how God is the most wonderful being there is, we're not going to want to do things that are at odds with being with Him forever. You know, so in one sense, true charity, someone who's really desiring to do what God wills, in one sense, that even transcends the question of salvation or damnation, because it's not even enter your mind. If you really love God, you want what God wants. You're not going to say, well, I'm not going to do this simply because I might go to hell. That, of course, that's sort of the minimum. That's, as my friend Doug Bushman says, that's sort of backing your way into virtue, right? Someone who truly loves God is going to say, and when we say this in the act of contrition, you know, I'm heartily sorry for having offended you. Why? Sure, because I dread the loss of heaven and the pains of hell, but most of all, because what? My sins offend you, who are all good and deserving of all my love. And if we love God above everything else, you know, it's not going to be so much a question of not wanting to go to hell. But we have to take Jesus' warnings about damnation very seriously.
All right, and we'll move on from Joseph, but it's a good question. And you know what they say, Mark, if you aim for heaven and miss, you get purgatory. But if you aim for purgatory and miss, well, I can't help you there. Katie is That's listening right. in Buffalo, New York on the Catholic Answers app. Katie, what's your question for Mark Brumley?
My question is, my husband and I have been married 10 years. We've got three children together, and we both raised Catholic. He more sacramentalized and not really evangelized per se. And throughout our marriage, he'll bring up periodically, let's check out other faith communities. And, you know, my friends at Wesleyan, they said, we're going to love it there. And I really want to expose the children to other faiths. And not that I mind ever going to another service if it's someone's funeral or something like that, but I really don't want to confuse our children when we're trying to catechize them. And I'm very certain with my faith. So it's really hard for me to respond to him. I've encouraged him to talk to our pastor or priest that we're friendly with, and he doesn't really take the lead on that. And I just thought maybe you'd have some insight for me.
Well, Katie, I think your instincts are right there. Would your husband feel comfortable about letting your children make up their own minds about whether they're, let's say, going to engage in murder or whether they're going to grow up and respect other people, that sort of thing? Would he say, ultimately, you got to make up your own mind about those kind of fundamental moral issues?
I don't think so.
Right. So he's got certain convictions that he thinks are core and foundational, and he loves his children so much he wants to make sure that those convictions are their convictions because he thinks they're good and true and important. And I think, you know, you can rightly say, well, wait a minute, you know, my Catholic faith is a similar kind of conviction that I think is important for our children. Ultimately, they're going to have to make up their own minds, but I'm not going to wait until they're, you know, 18 or 21 or 30 years old to try to help them see the value of my Catholic faith, just as we wouldn't wait until they were 18 or 20 or 30 years old to have settled moral convictions on fundamental issues. We try to inculcate those values in our children very early on. Ultimately, parents can't compel their children to believe, nor can they compel them to adopt the same moral codes or ethical values that we parents have. We can do our best to model those things, to teach those things, pray for our children, give them good examples, but in the end, they're going to have to make up their own minds. So if that's true about ethical values, it seems to me it's reasonable to say that it's true with respect to something we hold very dear, which is our Catholic faith.
Does that help a little bit, Katie?
Yeah, I've just always taken my faith. I went, you know, K through college and Catholic school, and it's hard for me to articulate. I mean, besides the Eucharist, like what's, you know, why is it better? And I know the other Christian faiths were all kind of offshoots. And like, why not stick to the true one? But I think he often feels like, oh, you Catholics are so uppity. And right. Look down on other people, which they certainly don't. But I just don't need to go searching elsewhere.
Yeah, well, there are a number of things that, you know, you could be added to this discussion, Katie. Bear in mind that neither Mark nor myself are in the faith that our parents raised us in. I mean, we're in Christianity, right? But we're both adult converts to the Catholic faith.
Wait a minute. You're an adult?
Oh, yeah.
I'm not. I'm still.
I'm overplaying my hand here, Mark, aren't I?
Yeah.
Oh well. But that being said, that, you know, at a certain point, your kids are going to have to own their spiritual deal.
That's right.
I mean, that's just how it is. And you know, it's your responsibility. I mean, if you had them baptized, you made the vows that said, and your husband would have made those vows too if he was there, that said that you would raise them in the church. And so at least if you can appeal to that, that's something to go on. Again, though, you know, that only goes so far, right? Because as adults, you know, St. Peter doesn't stand at the gate and say, were your parents Catholic, right? Did they put you through Catholic school? So yes. Yeah.
So I, you know, if I understand you, Katie, you're looking for some recommendations on resources. I think I would recommend the book Love Unveiled by Ted Sri. Last name is S-R-I. Edward Sri. It's called Love Unveiled, and Ignatius Press publishes that. Trent Horn has a book called Why We Are Catholic. That's published by Catholic Answers. I think those are two great resources that you might share with your husband. I don't think that they're particularly triumphalistic. I think they're pretty straightforward.
Yeah, there are a lot of things out there. I mean, maybe just hearing some conversion stories as well. We've got those at the Coming Home Network in spades. Just hearing somebody else tell their story. Sometimes that's easier to do than having somebody read a book. Sometimes a book gets through to some people that nothing else will get through. So we're going to take more calls after the break. Give us a call, 888-318-7884. Back after this.
Catholic Answers Live.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture's moral center continues to fly apart, and with every form of deviance publicly aired and celebrated, we have no choice but to equip our kids to understand about such issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. Silence can no longer be an option. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging on to the shop at Catholic.com.
The world is changing. The days of picking up a book or popping a DVD or compact disc in the player have given way to the digital age. The good news is that the shop at Catholic.com has joined the digital revolution. Check out the new digital platform at shop.catholic.com, where all of our DVDs, books, and audio products are now available in digital form for you to purchase and download at your convenience, anywhere you go. For that matter, anywhere in the world. We've got hundreds of offerings, so visit shop.catholic.com today and check out our selection. That's shop.catholic.com.
That music means we're back live on Catholic Answers Live, which means we can take your calls live for Mark Brumley. Again, the number to get in and on the line is 1-888-318-7884. If we don't get to your call this hour, Jimmy Akin's coming up next hour with another full hour of Q&A open forum. Before we get back to the calls, I want to remind you that we're kicking off our annual fall store-wide sale this week at Catholic Answers. And that means that you can save money on all the great stuff you hear about on Catholic Answers Live. If you go to the site, Catholic.com, and enter CALIVE18, did you catch that, Mark? It's CALIVE18 at checkout.
I'm writing this down.
You're writing that down. Shop.catholic.com is where you enter that code to save 20% off almost everything in the online store, which means resources by Jimmy Akin, Trent Horn, as you just mentioned, Christopher Check, all your favorite Catholic authors. And you know what? Christmas is coming, Mark. The goose is getting fat. So maybe this is a time to stock up ahead of Christmas.
Hey, you should mention my book.
Yeah. RCIA classes are in full swing as well. Get a stack of books for those people in RCIA as well. So CA Live 18, shop.catholic.com. Go save some money and get some good stuff.
Yeah. All right. Don't forget my book.
Which one's that?
How Not to Share Your Faith is the old title, but it's now called The 7 Deadly Sins of Catholic Apologetics.
Well, that's a lot spicier.
That's a revised edition. So those of you who got the first edition should get the second. If you haven't gotten either, you should get the second edition today.
I have multiple editions of, you know, Fellowship of the Ring based on the cover. So, yeah, I mean, that's worth it to me. Go for
it. That's awesome. That is awesome.
All right,
awesome.
Alex is listening in California on the Catholic Answers app. Alex, what's your question for Mark Brumley?
Hi, Mark. I'm getting married this weekend, and so I kind of wanted to ask the listeners to pray for me and Patty, my fiance, and also wanted to hear what's the best marriage advice you've heard.
Oh, my gosh, Mark. This is some serious pressure.
Yeah. Alex, congratulations, man. What would I say? Well, best advice I could give you is pray, pay, and obey, right? Pray, pay, and obey. I used to say that about the position of the laity in the church. I think that was always a little bit of a mischaracterization, but they used to say, you know, laity's role is to pray, pay, and obey. But I would say your role as a husband is to pray. Obviously, pray for yourself and your spouse. Pray for your wife to be Patty. And then pay. What does that mean? Well, that means not talking about money, although obviously you should support your family. By pay, I mean you got to pay your dues. That is to say, you're going to have rough times. You should accept that going in. You know, I know you're in love and all of this, and that's exciting, and it's a thrill, and you get married and all that. But you're going to have to pay your dues, which means there's going to be suffering. She's going to drive you nuts by how she squeezes the tube of toothpaste. And you're going to drive her nuts by how you eat, the dinner table, all that kind of stuff. So you got to pay your dues by loving each other and accepting each other. And you're going to have arguments and all of that. But if you pray together and you love each other and you pay your dues, you'll have a successful, that is to say, a faithful marriage. Lastly, obey, you know. And I don't mean just that your wife is supposed to obey you as the husband. I mean a kind of mutuality in obedience. You guys, you're going to be obedient to God. You're committed to God and one another. And you make a commitment, you have to be obedient to that commitment. When you give yourself wholly to your wife, when you get married this weekend, you're committing to her. You're promising to act consistent with your commitment. You're going to be obedient to your commitment to be her husband and to put her first, next only to God in your life. And it's going to be hard to live that out at times. I've been married now 35 years, almost 36 years. And I know my wife would say, I'm still working at it, you know. So that would be my advice. Pray for each other and for to be good spouses. Pay your dues and being faithful and living your lives together. And obey your mutual marriage commitments that you make.
Oh wow, that's good. That's good, solid stuff. Alex, did you write any of that down?
I'll listen to it on YouTube.
Oh, there you go. I'll give you one piece that's a little more practical, but will save you so much trouble. And that is, don't talk badly about your spouse to your own parents or coworkers or friends.
Ooh, that's powerful.
Because I'll tell you what'll happen, Alex. They know you better than they know Patty. And you know what? They're going to take your side and they're going to pile onto Patty and they're going to take the little anger or frustration or mild irritation that you had about her and they're going to demonize her for you without meaning to.
Yeah, that's really good advice.
Most of the problems that you and Patty have can be solved with you and Patty. Unless it's a severe, crazy emergency, don't talk badly about your spouse to anybody. Unless it's like
the
police or something.
Alex, do you pray with Patty? Ever pray with Patty?
Yeah, we pray regularly.
Great, excellent. That's wonderful. Very good. Well, we'll be praying for you here.
And congratulations, Alex.
Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, awesome. Well, I don't know if Andreas is going to top that. Listening in New Mexico on 96.7 FM, but we'll welcome him to the show anyway. Andreas, how are you?
Real good. Thank you for taking my call. I've got a question and a commendation. First, the question. When does the Catholic Church say that life begins? The big thing going on now on the possibility of the overturning of the Roe v. Wade with a new judge, hopefully being able to get in there, and there's a big fear of that, you know. And you know, I've always, here comes a commendation, I've always commendated the Catholic Church for always standing pro-life. You know, there's a bumper sticker that says you can't be both Catholic and pro-choice. You got to either be one or the other. And, you know, and the thing is, you know, the word, in my understanding, the word abortion is nothing short of murder, you know, but it's, abortion is a mild word for murder. And again, I commend the Catholic Church for always standing, you know, firm on that belief. And I think, you know, God really merits that.
Mark, I wonder if you could comment on that. This is actually a fairly solid teaching of the church. This is not something that Mark has to hem and haw about.
That's right. Church, life, human life begins at conception. From the very first moment of conception, that means we have a distinct human being with a life of his or her own. So when I say his or her, I'm not just trying to be gender inclusive or whatever. I want to make the point that sexual identity is bound up with the genetic identity of the unborn human life, and that begins at conception. And the church is taught that at that moment of conception, we have a distinct individual human being to whom obligations attached. That includes the obligation to respect the dignity of that life, and therefore we may not end that life. We may not end that life through abortion or anything like that. So I think, Andreas, your instinct is correct. The church has stood firm with respect to this question about abortion and human life. It isn't really a particularly religious question as to when human life begins. That's a biological question, and to some degree a philosophical question. But the church affirms what science tells us, that life begins at conception. And the church affirms what common sense and moral reflection tells us, that one, if all human beings have an inherent dignity and value, that once you have a human being, then that human being is a subject of rights and has that inherent dignity and value. And therefore, that human being's life may not be ended through abortion.
All right. Well, I hope that helps, Andreas. I suspect that we said what you probably already suspect.
I think so.
I think so. But it's good to get that back out there every now and then, just as a solid reminder of the principles of that the church upholds about defending every human life from conception to natural death. Mark, you want to tackle one more before the break?
Sure, absolutely.
Let's go to Beth in Overland, Kansas. Beth, what's your question for Mark Brumley?
Hi, thanks for having me. So my question is, what was the order that the Gospels were written? And who wrote each of the four Gospels?
Okay, well,
an easy question and a hard question, right?
Yeah, so the four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So we call it Gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. So those are the traditional names associated with the Gospels and the traditional authors of the Gospels. What's the order? We don't know for sure. It used to be thought, based on early traditions in the church, that Matthew wrote first and that Mark wrote after Matthew, then Luke, and then lastly John. That's why we have that order, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. In more recent times, scholars looking at Matthew, Mark, and Luke and comparing them and seeing how they have much in common and seeing what's different about them and how the differences might point to questions of the order in which they live or which they were written, have speculated that Mark was the first gospel written and that Matthew, then when he went to write his gospel, he used Mark and some other common material that we find in Luke as well, and then some of his own material. And then it's speculated that Luke did something similar to that, that he used Mark and some other common material and then some distinctive material of his own, and then John sort of was on his own. Now, that's a speculation based on a complex process that I can't explain in the short time we have here. The long and the short of it is we don't know for sure, but probably the most common scholarly opinion today is that Mark wrote his gospel first, and then Matthew, Luke, and then John wrote. But it's certainly not crazy to hold a more traditional order. You just have to account for some of the difficulties or objections that scholars are going to raise to that. So now there's some question. We say Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John wrote the Gospels. What do we mean by wrote? So someone might say, well, did Matthew, the tax collector, follower of Jesus, former tax collector, follower of Jesus, actually write Matthew? And if he did, why is it that he would have used Mark, assuming that Mark wrote first? And we can get into all kinds of questions like that. You say the earliest traditions we have about authorship of the gospel we attribute to Matthew is that Matthew wrote it, and it would be odd to single him out of all the apostles, to single Matthew out as the author of that gospel if he was not associated with it in some way as author. Similarly, Mark, Mark was not, certainly he wasn't one of the 12, wasn't one of the original 12, or even the sort of adapted 12 that after Judas's defection. Why would Mark come to be associated with this work if he wasn't its author? And likewise, Luke. Luke was an associate of St. Paul, but he wasn't one of the 12. So it's you can't sort of look at these Gospels and say, well, we affixed names to them because we wanted to associate them with these prominent people. Well, only Matthew and John were among the original 12. And if I were going to pick an apostle to associate my gospel with, if I weren't that apostle and I was writing it, I certainly wouldn't pick Matthew. So we have good reasons for thinking that the people who are identified with the particular gospels are actually those authors. Now, I can't, in the very short period of time I have here, review all the early historical evidence, internal evidence, and things of that sort. But the short answer is Matthew wrote Matthew, Mark wrote Mark, Luke wrote the Gospel according to Luke, and John wrote the Gospel according to John. Much more to it. I've oversimplified it, but that's it in a nutshell.
All right. Well, I hope that helps you at least a little bit, Beth. And, Mark, just to kind of put a nice bow on it, scholars are generally in agreement that Mark wrote first, but they're in unanimous agreement that Han shot first.
So that's right. Everybody agrees to that.
Everybody knows that. All right, it is Catholic Answers Live. We're going to hit a quick break. Mark Brumley from Ignatius Press is taking your calls at 1-888-318-7884. I'm Matt Swain from the Sunrise Morning Show and the Coming Home Network, filling in for Cy today. We'll take more of your questions from Patrick, Colleen, Anna, and a whole lot more after the break.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
We need Catholic radio because we need the voice of the church in the public forum. We live in a time that the secular voice dominates so thoroughly that we need to get that Catholic perspective out. Just as Fulton Sheen used radio and TV in the last century, we need to continue to use. This means to announce the Catholic faith in the public forum.
Bishop Robert Barron thinks Catholic radio is important. So should you.
A generation ago, Christian parents didn't have to worry about how to explain transgenderism to their 9-year-old children or help their teenager deal with mockery at school for believing in traditional marriage. But today, as our culture decays, we have to know how to talk to our children about these issues. In Made This Way, How to Prepare Kids to Face Today's Tough Moral Issues, Layla Miller and Trent Horn give parents the crucial tools and techniques to form children with the understanding they need, appropriate to their age and maturity level, to meet the world's challenges. If we're not teaching our children how to understand tough moral issues, then the world will. Read Made This Way and learn how to give your kids a firm foundation on which to build a life of moral clarity and happiness. Order your copy of Made This Way today by calling 1-888-291-8000 or logging onto the shop at Catholic.com.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
back on Catholic Answers Live. I'm Matt Swaim. You may have heard my work on the Sunrise Morning Show. You may have seen some of what we do at the Coming Home Network. We produce The Journey Home. And, Mark, we like to joke that after Catholic Answers kind of answers all these questions for people about the Catholic Church and they decide, oh, no, I have to become Catholic. And that's when they come to us and we help them with things like, how do I tell my Bible study? You know, or things like that. So
that's right.
We invite you to go visit us at chnetwork.org and go visit Mark at Ignatius Press's website. You want to throw that out there?
Ignatius.com. People that want to come to our 40th anniversary celebration in San Francisco can go to Ignatius.com and find out more about it.
It's always easier to get this stuff out at the beginning because when the music starts here at the end, Mark, there's no way we're getting all that out.
Hard. It's very difficult.
And with just a few minutes left to go in this hour of the show, I do want to let you know if you're on hold, stay on hold because next hour we've got another full hour of Q&A open forum with Jimmy Akin, senior apologist at Catholic Answers. So stay on the line. And if you want to get on the line, it's 1-888-318-7884. Let's go to Teresa listening in North Dakota on 91.7 FM. Teresa, what's your question for Mark Brumley?
Yes, why isn't Cardinal McCarrick being punished?
So he is being punished right now. He's been told that he has to live a life of penance and prayer. But I assume you mean why isn't he being punished more than that? Is that your question?
Yep.
I wish I knew the answer to that because it seems to me that there should be more done. I suspect that a canonical trial, that is to say a trial according to canon law, will be forthcoming and that he might be removed from the clerical state, that is to say removed from being a cleric, that is to say a deacon, a priest, or bishop in his case, he's an archbishop. There may be some hesitancy to do that because the general sense is that if that's done, the church has less control over him once he's no longer an archbishop. But the church has only so much control over him right now as he's willing to grant the church. It's not like the church's civil authority can put him in prison for what he's done. So long as he wants to be identified with the Catholic community, so long as he wants to be identified as a bishop, he will do what the church has told him to do to try to, it doesn't make up for it, but to do some penance for the evil things that he's done. I'd like to see more, and I really would like to see some more accountability and transparency regarding how he came to have the position he had in the church. Who knew what about what he was doing all these years? Why is it that these allegations that were apparently known by some people in the church were not known in such a way as to result in his suspension sooner? I'd like to know that. I think it's important for the credibility of the church in dealing with issues of clergy sexual abuse that this information come out and come out soon, which is why I've been from the beginning saying we need a full independent investigation of this McCarrick business, who knew what, when, and so on. And I don't think it's adequate to just be quiet about it and for him to go off somewhere and live a life of penance and prayer. As great as it is that that's happening, I think there's much more that needs to be done. That's just Mark Brumley's opinion.
Yeah, well, if you want just Matt Swaim's opinion, I think that right now we just don't know what we don't know. We really don't know. We know that allegations have been confirmed, that you know they are not, mostly not, of a criminal nature, or statutes of limitations have passed, or you know, it's hard to know what we don't know. It's hard to know who's hiding what. It's hard to know what's in files that aren't opened. It's hard to know that if he were to really go down, if there might be people who would go down with him who don't deserve to go down. It's just hard to know what we don't know.
Right, and that's why I think it's important to have an independent investigation with skilled forensic investigators and people who have a prudent sense of confidentiality, not people trying to cover things up, not people going to a radical extreme of transparency where you know everything gets published without regard to innocent people's reputation or harm that might be done to them. Obviously, there's a prudent middle ground But we need to have independent in my opinion, an independent investigation that looks at all these questions and finds answers. The church's credibility will continue to suffer until these things are addressed.
Yeah, amen, amen. And I say, bring on the chastisement if it purifies the body of Christ. That's how I feel about it. So, all right, let's go to Patrick in Columbus, Ohio on the EWTN app. Patrick, what's your question for Mark Brumley?
Oh, thank you guys for taking my call. The reason I'm calling is with the LGBT movement and the transgenderism that's going on these days, it's like a moral decline, okay? So you've got these people going, well, I identify as a male or I identify as a female. Are we going to see this taper off into the church as it seems with the scandals going on? And this is, it's almost like an infiltration. Are we going to see a woman who identifies herself as a male go, well, I want to be a priest, and if you don't let me be a priest, oh, well, then you're discriminating me. And, you know, and then the next thing you know, we've got some hotshot California lawyer trying to sue the church to break, you know, canon law.
Well, when Mark, it comes
there's
to
a
California.
Lot, there's a lot going in, on in there, but I think that you can address this one in somewhat simple terms.
Yeah, so when it comes to California lawyers, who knows what you're going to get. But I'll say this. To be a priest, you have to be a man. And to be a man, you have to be biologically a man. It doesn't matter if you're a woman and you think you're a man, or if you're a woman and you'd like to be a man, or you're a woman and you undergo physical alteration of your body to try to make yourself be a man in your own mind. No, you have to be biologically a man to be a priest, because priests represent the husbandly spousal relationship of Christ to his church. And that's not something women can do, and it's not something, it's not a characteristic that you acquire through a process of manipulation or alteration of your body. So,
yeah, and you know, to this is an oversimplification as well, but it's the same reason that you can't consecrate, you know, pizza
right
as the Eucharist. It's you don't have the right form. I mean, you don't have the right matter, I should say. And
that's right.
The proper
and,
matter for ordaining to the priesthood would be an
you know, and we need to be
male.
Aware that there are people who suffer from, you know, psychosexual dissociation where they think of themselves as a different sex than they are biologically, and that is a grave cross that people can suffer, and they certainly need help and support, but that ought not to take the form of pretending that that you can be a man when you are biologically a woman, or that you can be a woman when you're biologically a man.
Yeah, and again, this, you know, you can dig into kind of the sacramental theology of this, but in order for a sacrament to take place, you have to have not just the proper form liturgically
right.
for ordination, but also the proper matter, which is, you know, a male. And, you know, Jesus selected
right.
males.
And
I mean,
sacraments
he could have selected his
signs
mother, but he didn't.
And there are signs that resemble the thing that they're pointing to. And part of the sacramental sign in the Sacrament of Holy Orders for a priest is that the priest be a man. That's part of the signification, what points to the reality that you can't see, namely Christ himself as the bridegroom, the spousal, husbandly, male identity of the one who is ordained points to that reality of Christ as bridegroom of the church that you can't see. So that's part of the Sacrament of Holy Orders, and you got to be male.
Yeah, all right. Well, that sums it up, and there's a lot more to be said on that particular topic, but I don't know about you, Mark. I hear the music, and that means this hour has flown. You mentioned the 40th anniversary celebration for Ignatius Press. Real quick, where can we get more information on that?
Go to ignatius.com/40 and check it out. You'll see the outstanding lineup we have for the upcoming conference. So.
All right, sounds good. And in the meantime, stay on the line. Jimmy Akin's coming up with another full hour of a Q&A open forum next. I'm Matt Swaim. Thanks for being with us on Catholic Answers Live. Call us, 888-318-7884 to get on the line. 888-318-7884. back after this.